His brain pal merrily began to unpack everything Jared's mates had learned. Jared leaned back into the stairs and watched the sunset as the information branched and expanded. Phoenix's sun had well and truly set by the time Jared had unpacked all his new learning. He sat inside the small pool of light illuminating the barracks and watched Phoenix's analog to insects zip around the light. One of the more ambitious of these small creatures landed on Jared's arm and plunged a needle-like proboscis into his flesh to suck out his fluids. A few seconds later, it was dead. The nanobots in Jared's smart blood, alerted to their situation by his brain pal, self-immolated inside the tiny animal, using the oxygen they carried as a combustible agent. The poor creature crisped from the inside. Minuscule and almost invisible wisps of smoke vented out of its spicules. Jared wondered who it was who programmed that sort of defensive response into his brain pal and smart blood. It seemed hateful of life in its intent. Maybe the real-born are right to fear us, Jared thought. From inside the barracks, Jared could perceive his squadmates arguing about what they had learned that night. Seaborg just declared Frankenstein's monster a boar. Jared launched himself inside to defend the monster's honor. During the morning and afternoons of the first week, the Eighth learned to fight, to defend, and to kill. In the evenings, they learned everything else, including some things Jared suspected were of questionable value. In the early evening of the second day, Andrea Gelman introduced the Eighth to the concept of profanity, which she picked up at lunch and shared just before dinner. At dinner, members of the Eighth enthusiastically told each other to pass the fucking salt, you fucking sack of shit, until Brahe told them to quit that goddamn shit, cocksuckers, because it got old pretty goddamn quick. There was general agreement that Brahe was correct, until Gelman taught the squad to swear in Arabic. On the third day, members of the Eighth asked for and received permission to enter the mess hall kitchens and use the ovens and certain ingredients. The next morning, the other training squads at Camp Carson were presented with enough sugar cookies for every recruit and their superior officers. On the fourth day, the members of the Eighth tried to tell each other jokes they had found on the Phoenix data net, and mostly failed to make them work. By the time their brain pals unpacked the context of the joke, it was no longer funny. Only Sarah Pauling seemed to be laughing most of the time, and it was eventually determined she was laughing because she thought it was funny that none of the rest of them could tell a joke. No one else thought that was funny, to which Pauling laughed hard enough to fall off her cot. They all agreed that was funny. Also, puns were all right. On the fifth day, during which the afternoon was spent in an informational session about the disposition of the human colonies and their relationship with other intelligent species, which was to say, bad all the time, the Eighth critically evaluated pre-colonial era speculative fiction and entertainments about interstellar wars with aliens. The verdicts were reasonably consistent. The War of the Worlds met with approval until the ending, which struck the Eighth as a cheap trick. Starship Troopers had some good action scenes, but required too much unpacking of philosophical ideas. They liked the movie better, even though they recognized it was dumber. The Forever War made most of the Eighth unaccountably sad. The idea that a war could go on that long was almost unfathomable to a group of people who were a week old. After watching Star Wars, everyone wanted a lightsaber and was irritated that the technology for them didn't really exist. Everyone also agreed the Ewoks should all die. Two classics stuck with them. Ender's Game delighted them all. Here were soldiers who were just like them, except smaller. The main character was even bred to fight alien species like they were. The next day, the members of the Eighth greeted each other with the salutation, "Ho, Ender," until Brahe told them to knock it off and pay attention. The other was Charlie's Homecoming, one of the last books before the colonial era began, and one of the last books, therefore, to be able to imagine a universe other than what it was, one where the alien species humanity would meet greeted them with a welcome instead of a weapon. The book was eventually adapted into a film. By that time, it was clear it wasn't science fiction, but fantasy, and a bitter one at that. It was a flop. The members of the Eighth were transfixed by both the book and film, captivated by a universe they could never have, and one which would never have had them because they wouldn't be needed. On the sixth day, Jared and the rest of the Eighth finally figured out what that sex thing was all about. On the seventh day, and as a direct consequence of the sixth day, they rested. "They're not of questionable value," Pauling said to Jared about the things they had learned, as they lay together in her cot late on the seventh day, intimate but not sexual. "Maybe all of these things don't have any use in themselves, but they bring all of us closer together." "We are closer together," Jared agreed. "Not just like this." Pauling pressed herself into Jared briefly and then released. "Closer as people, as a group. All of those things you mentioned are silly, but they're training us how to be human." It was Jared's turn to press himself into Pauling, snuggling into her chest. "I like being human," he said. "I like you being human, too," Pauling said, and then audibly giggled.
"For fuck's sake, you two," Seaborg said. "I'm trying to sleep over here."
"Grump," Pauling said. She looked down at Jared to see if he would add anything, but he had fallen asleep. She kissed him lightly on the top of his head and then joined him.
"In your first week, you physically trained to do all the things real-born soldiers can do," Brahe said. "Now it's time to train you to do things only you can do."
The Eighth stood at the beginning of a long obstacle course.
"We've already run this course," said Luke Gulstrand.
"Good of you to notice, Gulstrand," Brahe said. "For your observational skills, you get to be the first one to run it today. Stay here. The rest of you spread out over the length of the course, please, as equally as possible."
Presently, members of the Eighth were strung along the course. Brahe turned to Gulstrand.
"You see the course?" he asked.
"Yes,"
Gulstrand said.
"Do you think you could run it with your eyes closed?"
"No,"
Gulstrand said. "I don't remember where everything is. I'd trip over something and kill myself." "Do you all agree?" Brahe asked.
There were pings of affirmation.
"And yet, all of you will run this course with your eyes closed before we leave here today. Because you have an ability that will allow you to do this. Your integration with your squad members."
From around the squad came varying levels of skepticism.
"We use our integration to talk and to share data," said Brian Michelson. "This is something entirely different."
"No, not different at all," Brahe said. "The nighttime assignments of the last week were not just punishments and frivolity. You already knew that through your brain pal and your pre-birth conditioning, you could learn quickly by yourself. In the last week, without realizing it, you've learned to share and absorb immense amounts of information between yourselves. There is no difference between that information and this. Pay attention."
Jared gasped audibly, as did other members of the Eighth. In his head was not only the presence of Gabriel Brahe, but an intimate sensation of his physical presence and personal situation, overlaid on Jared's own consciousness.
"Look through my eyes," Brahe said.
Jared focused on the command, and then had a sickening sense of vertigo as his perspective wheeled from his own vantage point to Brahe's. Brahe panned left and right, and Jared saw himself looking toward Brahe. Brahe snapped off the view.
"It gets easier the more you do it," Brahe said. "And from now on, in every combat practice, you will do it. Your integration gives you situational awareness that is unique in this universe. All intelligent species share information in combat, however they can. Even real-born soldiers keep a communication channel open through their brain pals during battle. But only special forces have this level of sharing, this level of tactical awareness. It's at the heart of how we work and how we fight. As I said, last week you covered the basics of fighting like the real-born. You learned how to go into combat as an individual. Now it's time to learn to fight like special forces, to integrate your combat skills with your squad. You will learn to share, and you will learn to trust what is shared with you. It will save your life, and it will save the life of your squad mates. This will be the hardest and most important thing you learn. So pay attention.
Brahe turned back to Gullstrand.
Now, close your eyes.
Gullstrand hesitated.
I don't know if I can keep my eyes closed, he said.
You're going to have to trust your squad, Brahe said.
I trust the squad, Gullstrand said. I just don't trust myself.
This got a sympathetic round of pings.
That's part of the exercise as well, Brahe said. Off you go.
Gullstrand closed his eyes and took a step. From his vantage point, halfway down the course, Jared could see Jerry Yukawa, in the first position, lean in slightly, as if physically attempting to close the distance between his mind and Gullstrand's. Gullstrand's passage through the obstacle course was slow, but became progressively steadier. Just before reaching Jared and just after balancing on a wood beam suspended over mud, Gullstrand began to smile. He had become a believer. Jared felt Gullstrand reach for his point of view. Jared gave him full access to his senses and passed along a feeling of encouragement and assurance. He sensed Gullstrand receiving it and briefly passing along his thanks. Then Gullstrand focused on scaling the rope wall Jared stood to the side of. At the top, he felt Gullstrand move on to the next squad member in the line, fully confident. By the end of the course, Gullstrand was moving nearly at full speed.
Excellent, Brahe said. Gullstrand, take over that last position. Everybody else move down one position. Yukawa, you're up.
Two run-throughs later, not only were members of the squad sharing their perspective with the squadmate running the course, the squadmate on the course was sharing his shared perspective with them, giving everyone who hadn't run through the course a preview of what was coming up next. The next run-through after that had the squadmates on the side sharing vantage points with the person one station up from them, so they could better help the person on the course when they shifted into the position. By the time Jared was himself on the court, the entire squad had fully integrated their perspectives and were getting the hang of quickly sampling another perspective and picking out the relevant information without breaking from their own point of view. It was like being in two places at once. When Jared was on the course himself, he exulted in the strange intelligence of it all, at least until the beams over the mud, when his borrowed visual vantage point suddenly wheeled away from where his feet were. Jared missed his footing and fell flat into the mud.
"Sorry about that," said Stephen Seaborg a few seconds later as Jared pulled himself out, eyes open. "I got bit by something. Distracted me."
"Bullshit," Alan Milliken sent to Jared privately. "I was one station down and looking right at him. He didn't get bit."
Brahe cut in.
"Seaborg, when you're in combat, letting a squadmate get killed because of a bug bite is the sort of thing that gets you on the unfortunate side of an airlock," he said. "Keep it in mind. Dirac, keep moving."
Jared closed his eyes and put one foot in front of the other.
"What does Seaborg have against me, anyway?" Jared asked Pauling.
The two of them were practicing fighting with their combat knives. The squad members practiced for 5 minutes with each other member of the squad, with their integration sense on full. Fighting someone who is intimately aware of your internal state of mind made it an interesting extra challenge.
"You really don't know," Pauling
said, circling with her knife held casually in her left hand. "It's two things. One, he's just a jerk. Two, he likes me." Jared stopped circling.
"What?"
he said, and Pauling attacked viciously, feinting right and then slashing upward toward Jared's neck with her left hand. Jared stumbled backward and right to avoid the slashing. Pauling's knife switched hands and stabbed downward, missing Jared's leg by about a centimeter. Jared righted himself and settled into a defensive position.
"You distracted me," he said, circling again.
"You distracted yourself," Pauling said. "I just took advantage of it when it happened."
"You won't be happy until you cut open an artery," Jared said.
I won't be happy until you shut up and focus on trying to kill me with that knife, Pauling said.
You know, Jared began, and suddenly leaned back. He felt Pauling's intent to slash a fraction of a second before she made her lunge. Before she could pull back, Jared leaned back in, inside the reach of her extended arm, and brought up the blade in his right hand to touch it lightly to her ribcage. Before it got there, Pauling brought her head up and jammed it into the bottom of Jared's jaw. There was an audible clack as Jared's teeth slammed together. Jared's field of vision whited out. Pauling took advantage of Jared's stunned pause to step back and sweep his legs out from under him, spilling him flat on his back. When Jared came to, Pauling had pinned his arms with her legs and held her knife directly on top of a carotid artery.
"You know,"
Pauling said, mocking Jared's last words.
"If this were real combat, I'd have sliced four of your arteries by now and moved on to whoever was next."